KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The last chance for each of the candidates to really make their case to the American people.
I use disease and disfiguration as more of a metaphor rather than a fascination of the actual disease.
It's graphic novelist Charles Byrne talking about his work. We're going to talk to him in a few minutes. We're also going to talk about just what is to be expected from tonight's debate. We're going to talk to four women. Not that they will represent the entire population, but it is interesting that women seem to be the ones, in part, as Cokie Roberts said, because there's more of them, more women voting. You folks know that. You're voting, so there's more of you. But also because the women's vote seems to be fluid and changing in the aggregate. We'll talk to some individuals, see what they think. But we start with another thing about what's on our ballot right now. You may have gotten your State of Washington's voters pamphlet, or you may have looked at it online. You may have gotten your King County one. You may have noticed, what are some of these things I'm supposed to vote on? What's this? What are these joint resolutions from the Senate? What are these advisory votes? So we thought we'd take a few moments to actually figure that out. Kim Abel is co-president of the League of Women Voters of Washington. She joins us on the phone. Kim, thanks for talking to us.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Let's start with these amendments to the state constitution. What are those?
Well, it's not surprising that Washington has a way to change our constitution when we need to. And so both of these are from the legislature. They can only send it to the voters to change the constitution, and that's what we're being asked to look at. The first one, that 8221, regarding Washington's debt limit. And this is something that people are concerned about debt limits. It seems like a good idea to get a handle on it. And that's why the legislature put it before the voters, trying to get a new way to limit the debt limit, but also to even it out so that in down years, the debt limit can still get money to do the things we need to do when people are hurting.
Now, unlike the advisory votes we're going to take, these are, which came out of some initiatives, these are how we have gone about in the past changing the Constitution and changing the rules in the state.
Correct.
The Senate puts these up, and we vote on them. There are, they are in the voter's guide, there's arguments for, arguments against. So I always like to look at who prepared these arguments for and against, and I see in the argument for was prepared for this raising of the debt limit was Jim McIntyre, the Washington State Treasurer, is at the head of it, and I see Bob Hasegawa, state rep from the 11th district, is one of the people who opposed it. So did some other folks as well. But what's the underlying arguments that, as you've read it from both sides, what's the argument for raising the debt limit?
The argument, it's actually to lower the debt
limit. Lower the debt limit, sorry.
Right. And the argument for lowering the debt limit is really to make sure we do not carry too much debt and are allowed to borrow against the monies in the state when we need them. So during this downturn, there's not as much money to borrow against in the state. So that means you can borrow less and do less, such as repair roads and do those kind of things. So it helps stabilize the state's ability to borrow, because instead of doing it over 3 years, an average, to determine that, it's now going to be over six. And it's also going to include a larger share. It's going to lower the share of the operating budget. It's very archaic because the budgets are always archaic, just like at our own homes. Which part do we push to make things even out? But that's those in favor think it helps us in downtime about borrowing.
The people opposed to it say it's going to increase the costs of infrastructure and shift money away from schools to other programs.
Yes, and I think their concern is that it changes potentially. It might affect our credit rating by changing this around, and that it might local governments will have to take a bigger percentage to fund their own public works. And both of those are still, I think in all of these cases, it will depend on how much the legislature in the end decides to continue to put into supporting local sewer districts and community colleges and those kind of things in the capital budget.
Where are you learning more about this issue?
Well, luckily, the league every year does a kind of a shorthand version of all the ballot issues, and I'm happy to send our copies of those to you guys so you can have people link to them and look at those kind of that kind of information that we have available for everybody. You can go to our website and find it.
Yeah, no, I see it there. Do you feel that that this issue and the other issue have been sufficiently vetted that the voters can get a sense of it? You know, these are one of those things where people go, why am I voting on this?
And I think it. I think they have been. The legislature did pass it, and part of our belief, and most citizens' belief, is that we have a representative government, and so this is our check-in to make sure we agree with our representatives. And I think with you looking at what the amendment will do section on our website, you'll see to get a lot of information, and you'll have to make up your own mind. I wish I could tell you.
The other 8223 Senate Joint Resolution is about investments by the University of Washington and Washington State University. What is this one?
This one is, I think people may have heard the shorthand that Washington State is not allowed to invest in private enterprise and in shorthand to enrich private companies. And so over the years, we have fixed or changed our constitution to allow additional investment of state funds into other kinds of private enterprises. And so this would include now, besides those folks that already we use, the public pensions and industrial insurance, other kinds of funds that the state are allowed to be invested in private stocks and bonds. This would allow the University of Washington and Washington State University to do the same with their funds.
Again, this has got in the voter's guide. It's got the arguments for and arguments against. You guys weighed this as well. The arguments for is just that, to offer them more, as they argue it. They'll be managed well, but the citizens have already amended this, and we just want to get a better return on our investment dollar. That's the argument for. And what would you add to that?
Well, I think that folks now, universities across the nation are doing lots of research, and so I think in the idea that you could diversify your investment portfolio already to perhaps look into it says the fund's potential for investment include research funding, patient and medical revenues, parking proceeds, all the different funds that the university has would now be able to be used and looked at as part of within perhaps getting a higher rate of return in the private market rather than with government-backed securities.
But you see people in the argument against some legislators, among others, opposing it because they're afraid that they'll be gambling on Wall Street, will have disastrous effects when the stock market crashes again, cutting into university operating funds.
And that is a concern. So this is one of those things they want us to weigh in to say, which are we... When we go to our own folks for investment advice, we decide if we're more risk averse or not, and that's one of the things you'll have to weigh as you look at this one. Do you think we should allow the universities to do a little bit more investment? And in any case, it will be the Washington State Investment Board, who already manages a number of funds in the state, that will be doing this investment.
We're talking with Kim Abel about some of the I don't know if we'd call them down ballot measures, but I guess since for some people they're maybe seeing these for the first time when they open up their voters pamphlet. All right, the two advisory votes that are on the ballot as well, these exist as advisory votes because the legislature changed some taxes and therefore or eliminated some taxes and tax deductions, and because of the initiative that we voted on in the past for the 60%, among other things, we get this as an advisory vote. And that's why all the people who voted for and against it are listed in the voters pamphlet.
Right, and again, this is different than the others because the legislature does it will be information to the legislature that nothing happens because of our vote on this, but it is information to the legislature on whether folks feel these should be repealed, the action of the legislature should be repealed or maintained. And I want to just reiterate that it's two-thirds of the majority in both houses had to pass this to make it come onto our ballot.
Right. This is the final aspect of the initiative that we passed. The one that is being we're voting on it again, the two-thirds initiative. That is sort of the final thing, as Tim Iman had put it. You know, if the legislature does put something forward, you get the two-thirds majority, then there should be an advisory vote where they would be held accountable for their actions. Sorry, I'm putting that in quotes, but that's sort of the argument that was made when this initiative was passed. The first one, the legislature eliminated without a vote of the people, this is how it's written, a business and occupation tax deduction for certain financial institutions, interest on residential loans, costing $170 million in its first 10 years for government spending. They have a 10. Did you understand this? I was sort of having a little problem with this one. There's a 10-year cost projection on this elimination of the B&O tax deduction. I get a little turned around by that. Isn't it a tax increase?
Well, it is kind of both. So it's just like me, when my kids get too old for me to have an exemption on my federal taxes, I don't get that anymore. So in essence, the legislature is taking away a deduction, an opportunity for these certain financial institutions, as they say, which are mortgage originators that do business in more than 10 states. So that is part of that. That will be, they felt that was a reasonable thing to do. I don't remember or know for sure why that was reasonable at the time, and I don't have that up in front of me, but that the legislature by two-thirds majority, and they haven't been able to pass many things by two-thirds majorities that have to do with finance. So that says something.
This was about banks getting to benefit from our tax system, and that's sort of how it was projected and pitched,
right?
Financial institutions. But why is it a cost? Who's it a cost to? Is it a cost to the state? Isn't it an increase to the state?
It is. The state will receive more taxes from those certain financial institutions. That is correct.
So the $170 million, it says here, costing $170 million in its first 10 years, that's a cost to the people who are now going to pay the tax, not to the government for losing revenue.
So that
the government gets revenue.
The tax, right.
Yeah.
It also reduces taxes for certain. This Senate bill also reduced taxes for certain organizations in the state. So it doesn't totally for the whole this amount of money that was generated by this change is only approximately $24 million for the state, because it also reduces B&O tax for manufacturers of agricultural products, for newspapers, for leasehold excise tax for certain types of uses, and also for a retail sales tax for data center server equipment. So it's a really involved piece of Senate bill.
Yeah, but in the end, there's $24 million on the plus side coming into government coffers, and so 170 minus 24 for people paying higher taxes from financial institutions.
Right.
Over the 10 years.
Correct.
And the other advisory vote, the other one is on, again, legislature extended without a vote of the people, expiration of a tax on possession of petroleum products and reduce the tax rate. Did you understand? This one I didn't get.
Okay.
You explain this one to me.
So the House bill that was the final document or bill that was passed by two-thirds, again, both houses of the legislature, extends an existing tax that was established in 1889. So it was a tax that was sunsetted, unlike many loopholes and other taxes that don't have sunsets. This one was. So it was a tax that was established back in 1989 to fund pollution liability insurance, so that the folks who have underground petroleum storage tanks and underground heating oil tanks would be able to get insurance, because the insurance otherwise is very difficult to get, maybe not affordable for people on the private market. So that's what this tax was put in place for, and it helps get insurance for folks who have that in their backyards, both private and public, private businesses and private families.
And the legislature extended that?
It would extend it to 2020.
Yeah. costing $24 million in its first 10 years. So that is a cost in terms of money coming into the government coffers.
Right. So that money would be available to help fund that insurance fund.
Yes. This is why we have the legislature do these things, because they can spend more time in the nitty-gritty of it, right?
And these are very involved, and so both of these coming with two-thirds is something that means the legislature did take a hard look at it.
And now you get to vote on it as an advisory vote. It doesn't affect what has happened, but it will inform the legislature in months ahead, is the argument. Kim Abel, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Steve. Glad to be of service.
Kim Abel is co-president of the League of Women Voters of Washington. They are of service, and we'll have some links to some of the arguments they have made and analysis they've done of these and other issues at our website. This is KUOW.
Good morning, it's 10:21. I'm Andy Hurst. Earlier this month, the Seattle City Council approved a rental housing law that would require property inspections. We'll get all the details at 12:40 today, and we want to hear from you right now at our feedback line. Tell us about the worst or best landlord you ever had and why. 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663. Then tune in at 12:40.
Support for KUOW comes from Cupcake Royale, now featuring cupcakes decorated for Halloween and election parties, and the pumpkin cardamom made with local pumpkin. Cupcake Royale features natural, fresh, and local ingredients. Ordering information at cupcakeroyale.com.
We have cloudy skies and 47 degrees in Seattle's University District, working our way towards a high of 51 today. Forecast calls for clouds and showers. Same for tonight and tomorrow, clouds and rain. Tonight's low 43, tomorrow's high 51.
Charles Burns joins us now from Pennsylvania, but no politics. Charles Burns is an American cartoonist, illustrator, graphic novelist. His series and compilation, Black Hole, was lauded by many, many readers of graphic novels. And his latest, of which the second one is The Hive, is a new trilogy that's out. X'd Out was the first. The Hive is the second. And there's one more to come. Joins us in our studios. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Charles Burns' illustrations have been on the cover of bands, CDs that he likes, music that challenges him. I read that. Those are the people you put your art to. Also on many magazine covers, including The New Yorker, among others. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I was reading these reviews. I like to read reviews of when I read some of these, and many of the reviews were, these are incredible, but man, where's Charles Burns' brain at? Where is he going?
I've been getting that all my life. when I was a kid and drawing in grade school, you know, kids would come like, you must have really weird dreams. But I think the truth is that maybe I just pay attention to them more than other people, or try to get that down on paper.
Your dreams.
Yeah.
Are you pulling from your, I mean, this is a book of the subconscious. You're exploring psychology in a lot of your work. You're exploring a sort of angst, but angst doesn't really do justice to what you're exploring. Angst seems a little more trivial than what's going on.
I'm exploring the way I think and the way, you know, what I was going through in a specific period of my life. So the series of books, starting with X'd Out, really initially it was dealing only with this idea of going back to a period of my life in the late 70s when I was interested in punk music. I was living around the Bay Area and saw a lot of bands. And so I was trying to think of a story exploring that time of my life and being in art school, all those things. But I realized, you know, as I was working, it started expanding.
Put into your words the story so far in X'd Out and The Hive.
See, that's what I can't do. I mean, the thing is, in my comics, I slowly assemble stories, and there's it's kind of this cumulative process of starting with a thread, an idea, and building on that. So it's really hard for me to distill it into a you know, a boy meets girl, boy loses girl kind of story, and maybe that's what it is.
Well, you could say that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of it's a little bit of that. It's there's romance in there. There is you know, angst, as you were saying. There's I'm thinking about mortality. There's a lot of issues in there.
There's and there's lizard people and worms.
There's lizard people. There's always worms. You know, worms always, you know, crawl up to the surface in my work.
This character in is named Nit-Nit.
He's never really officially referred to as Nit-Nit. But he's a character that's in some ways based on Hergé's Tintin, which I think everybody knows now because of a movie that came out by Spielberg. But it was a series of books that I read when I was a really little kid, which is unusual for an American kid. There were a few that were published in the early 60s, and those were books that were given to me when I was, you know, five years old.
Somebody calls him in one review the anti-Tintin, though, because he's confused and passive, whereas Tintin was all about setting out.
Well, yeah, my character falls in love too, and there were no women in Tintin's world. Oh, there was like one or two, but it was primarily guys. There were no. You know, Tintin never had a mother or a father. He had plenty of friends, and there was no romance involved in that world.
There is this scene in the Hive where the character in the real world,
mm-hmm.
can I put it that way?
Yes, you may.
It puts on a mask.
Yes.
And it looks exactly like the character, not exactly, but it looks very similar to the character in the dream world.
Sure.
What's happening there?
There's a lot of places where you've got two threads of a story. You've got this kind of, I don't know, I don't want to call it fantasy, but you've got this character it's in this more of a dream world. And you've got the main protagonist, Dave, who's an art student. Does performance art, and when he's doing performance art, he puts this mask on that does resemble this other cartoon character. All these things in some ways mirror what I was going through that time. I did really bad performance art. I was interested in William Burroughs writing. I think a lot of people were at that time. So a lot of those things kind of seep up to the surface. I reflect on those things in the story.
How do I in Black Hole?
Mm-hmm.
You told me when I was moving graphically from the past to the present, or from one place to another, with the wavy lines in the frame box.
Okay, I have to think about that because it's almost intuitive for me. But go ahead, yeah.
How do I know where I am in this? Well, in reading this graphic novel,
you don't as much. There's moments where there's transitions that slip from one world to another, and there's imagery and characters that kind of seep in there as well. But yeah, it's not as clearly defined as that.
And was that deliberate on your part?
Yeah, very deliberate. So everything that's in there is very deliberate. I've set it up in a kind of a conventional way of drawing the panels. There's kind of a grid of three panels on top of each other.
It's very Tintin-esque.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly based on. I mean, I when I think of Tintin, I think of, you know, this beautiful color work that I looked at when I was growing up, and I wanted to work in color. I wanted to do something, you know, kind of based on the look of that of those books, but. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to have something that's very structured looking, but was able to kind of drift in very kind of difficult ways. The same way that there's not necessarily a real logic to your dreams, but they feel very logical as you're experiencing those. So I wanted to have a little bit of that sense in the reading experience.
Well, that reminds me of Burroughs or Bukowski, poetry. Much poetry can do that.
I mean, what Burroughs was doing in some of his experimental writing was literally using collage and cutting up his writing. And what he was trying to achieve is something using this kind of random, you know, assembling words together and having that be part of his writing. And with mine, it has a sense of being collaged together or pieces put together like that, but it's actually very deliberate. So the effect is very deliberate rather than random.
In terms, let me go back to Black Hole. So there was Black Hole was black and white.
Yes.
And as you say, this is the first time you worked in color?
I've always done illustration, and the illustrations are mostly in color, but it's the first comic I've done in color.
Well, just in terms of that deliberate effort, but as a graphic novel comes from comic books and comic books, and if you don't agree with this thesis, weigh in. Very deliberate narrative structure, right? A to B to C to D. They kind of messing with a little bit, and sometimes you had to sort of follow the flow of the image across the page to understand.
Yeah, someone would put a little arrow in there if they were doing a confusing, panel layout. But exactly. There's a pretty typical framework for traditional comics,
right? And a very typical framework for the narration. We knew where it was, from one panel to the next,
right,
one page to the next.
Sure.
We knew where it was going in the story. You blow all that up.
Yeah, well,
not all of it up. You blow much of it up.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess I'm writing in a way that's more the way my brain works. I'm associating this image with that, and I'm trying to figure out why I'm putting those images together. With this book, there's definitely a beginning, middle, and end.
The Hive and X'd Out and
yeah,
whatever.
And the
what's
la-
through
the last
called
book is called, yeah, the last book is called Sugar Skull.
Sugar Skull.
So when you sit and read all those books together, in theory, hopefully, it will be very clearly a story that's got a beginning, middle, and an end.
How do you feel about how this, and you are part of the evolution of this venue, graphic novels. How do you feel how it's evolved? Has it truly emerged the way you had hoped it would to be a unique aspect of the way we're telling stories today?
I mean, it's something that I've been doing since I was in grade school, into junior high school and high school. It was something I always wanted to do. I never really knew where that work would go. I would sit at home and draw my comics that were probably based on what I was interested in, underground comics at that time, early on. But I was drawing kind of elaborate stories and comics, but I didn't know where they'd be printed. And it is a medium that's been evolving, and what's really gratifying is being able to reach an audience that's not just this small specialty store sort of audience. If you walk into a bookstore, or if you get on Amazon or wherever it is, you can find the work. It's available. And there's also a significant amount of really very, very interesting stories. Back in the day, I think one of the first real breakthrough books was Art Spiegelman's Mao's. And I think the problem at that point was there just weren't enough other books that were of that caliber that were if you were interested in Mao's and thought, oh, graphic novels are great, and you'd go back to the bookstore and look around, you wouldn't find 10 other equally interesting books. These days you can. I mean, you've got a really wide range of artists, writers, and things that appeal to a very wide range of people, which is great. It's nice.
Charles Burns is our guest. His latest graphic novel from Pantheon is The Hive. Right, you go into a library, and there is the graphic. Sometimes there's the graphic novel section.
Right, yeah.
But in a lot of libraries, they are out in fiction. They are dispersed taken with as much credibility. And that was, would that the people who had done underground comics think they were going to be rising to that level years ago.
When I was working, I always wanted that idea of, having the book accessible and having it out there. I think I would have always been working one way or another, whether it was, going down to the copy store and photocopying my books, my art, and stapling it together and giving it to friends. I mean, that's what's nice about it too. It's a medium where you have complete control over it. You can sit at home with very simple tools, and you can photocopy, for example, and many people do. On the other hand, I'm lucky enough to have a great publisher who's putting out a beautiful hardbound book with a cloth spine, and that's the book that I envisioned when I was a kid, having a beautiful color book. and a story that I want to tell.
All right. So now I'll ask you this again.
What is that story about?
What is that story you wanted to tell in this one? Especially as we end, I'm not giving much away, especially as we end with the levels of comic that are here, the romance comic in the reality world, the romance comic in the other world, and then the reality world of the romance comic. And now we end up walking down the street with that dude, and all of a sudden here's this guy selling these sugar skulls,
right,
which are real things. I have one sitting on my desk.
They're real things, exactly.
And they have real sort of potent meaning in cultures.
Right. And I guess I sound like I'm being very evasive, but I really steer away from interpreting what's there. What I'm not good at is telling stories in public, for example. But what I do fairly well, hopefully, is sit at the drawing table all day and very carefully craft the stories, the words, and the images so they work together. And that's what the final product is. And I have very clear-cut ideas of what I'm trying to achieve and what the story's about. But for example, I've had people talk to me about Black Hole and say there was this and this and this in it, and I think that's an interesting interpretation. I want to have it open that way. I appreciate I always like questions more than answers, I guess.
I like this phrase, disorienting gaps in the narration that subvert the expectation, the conventions of comics, yet revel in its readers can, and you must revel in that disorienting journey.
Yeah, there's something that, yeah, I'm recently just for myself, I photocopied up all the artwork that I've done so far and cut it all up like William Burroughs and assembled it in a very linear way. And it's very odd. It starts to feel like a very, very different story. What makes the story unique is that it does have these, it's how all these images play off of each other, the two separate threads that are related but separate. That's what I'm trying to achieve. It's asking someone who's making music, you know, what does your music mean? It's what it is. But again, maybe that sounds a little pompous, but
no, I think that's fair. We don't ask musicians to explain.
Yeah.
Somebody else.
I mean, I don't know. For me, it's a lot of the images, are things that are very evocative, kind of visceral. I have a strong reaction to and yeah, it's hard to describe, you know, why I react that way, but they certainly have a real potency to them.
Google last week honored Little Nemo in Slumberland with their Google graphic.
Right.
The richness of those drawings sort of disappeared from comics until the arrival of the graphic novelists and artists like yourself. It's almost a revival of the art form.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a real range. I think that there's cartoonists who really have very intense artwork, or the work really kind of hinges on the visuals, and I think other artists are really kind of distill things down to very simple drawing to tell their stories. So I think there's a real range there, but I think most of the artists or people I know that are working do have that respect or interest in the kind of those beautiful early classic comics. You're talking about Winsor McCay's Little Nemo. That was a real kind of golden age where there weren't really any rules at that point. Everyone didn't quite know what that world was. And there was also this kind of big canvas that they could work on. It's like, okay, you have a Sunday page
Well, Charles Burns is one of those people remaking the rules. He's speaking tonight along with Chris Ware, Building Comics, 7:30 at Town Hall. He'll be performing in some other places.
That's what I do best.
Well, you were signing beer labels at the Elysian. That was pretty good.
Yes.
And his latest graphic novel from Pantheon Books is The Hive, part two of a trilogy coming out. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
This is Weekday.
Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Anybody at the Ramada Inn will tell you. The hotel's haunted. But not in any of the normal spooky ways that we normally think of as haunting. The ghost switches the TV channels in the rooms to C-SPAN, his favorite.
The computer. It just beeps all the time, and then I just tell it to shut up because I think it's Walter.
Be sure to listen. We'll leave the light on for you.
This American Life, Saturday morning at 11 o'clock. Good morning, it's 10:40. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College, a four-year public college in Olympia, where students are challenged to unlock their passion for learning in small, theme-based classes. Information available from representatives at fall college fairs and online at evergreen.edu/welcome.
We have cloudy skies in Seattle, 47 degrees right now in the University District. Forecast says clouds and rain today, tonight, and tomorrow. Today's high 51, tonight's low 43, tomorrow's high 51.
Support for KUOW comes from the Carlson Cello Foundation, providing students throughout the Puget Sound area an opportunity to play a lovely restored cello through long-term loan. Any used cello donated to the foundation will be restored for loan to a student. More at carlsoncellofoundation.org.
Now we're going to go around the water cooler and get a sense from four women who are going to represent all women voting in the country today about why the women's vote seems so fluid and what people are expecting from tonight's debate. Leah Baltus is editor of City Arts Magazine. Good to see you again.
Hello.
Sally Poliak is co-founder and mobilizer for Crowdverb, a digital-first PR firm, and for many years was talking to us about politics. It's been a long time. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Tracy Brooks is a delivery manager, and in defining that, oversight for large-scale technology infrastructure projects. And then you made it even easier, building data centers.
There you go.
For a Redmond-based technology services provider. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
She's also part of the meetup group Cascade Conservative Chicks. And Valerie Curtis-Newton is head of performance in the University of Washington School of Drama. Good to see you again.
Good morning.
So, okay, I do not matter in this equation, so please, why is the women's vote so fluid? Leah Baltus, how's that for a question to start with?
Well, that's a big one. I think a lot of it does have to do with how emotion factors into the election. And, you know, maybe women are responding in some way more to the outward presentation of the candidates than men are.
Sally?
You know, it's very interesting. We actually at Crowdverb, we've got this technology where we scan the entire internet, all publicly available signals.
Wow.
And then we map them to emotions, and which is fascinating in terms of being able to target people on the issues and understand why they are moved on the issues that they really care about. So this morning we actually looked at what women care about vis-a-vis the presidential election, and the five top emotions that they're focused on are apprehension and aversion, fear, disappointment, and optimism. And it seems that the folks, the women that are moving towards Romney are moved more by apprehension and aversion and fear. And I think that's the, you know, when you talk about what we're going to look at in terms of messaging down the road here in the next, 2 weeks, I think you're going to see a lot of that. And that's what's going to happen.
So are you saying, first of all, how are you doing that? How are you mapping emotions to these things? What are you looking for?
Well, we actually look at everything. We look at what's being said in the media, what's being said in social media, and we are able to put together some formulas that make sense of it all. So it's a patent-pending proprietary technology that is really able to make sense. It's beyond a lot of technologies that just do sentiment analysis. This actually understands what's being said so that it can be actionable.
Say those words again. Apprehension?
Apprehension, aversion, fear, disappointment, and then optimism.
Wow. So that's what you think people are working on?
I think actually that's off. What we know that they care about.
Okay. And they vote for that?
Is that determining their vote, those emotional?
If you're able to tap into those emotions, that would help move voters in your direction, women voters in your direction.
All right, Tracy Brooks, when you sit around and you're in the evening at Cascade Conservative Chicks, are you apprehensive?
No, I don't think apprehensive is the right word. I do have a high degree of concern over the direction that we're moving. I'm not sure, I guess it would be more concern, less apprehension. I don't believe that the country is unfixable. I do not believe that Barack Obama is going to drive us into this deep, dark pit of socialism, nor do I believe that Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan are going to push grandma off the cliff, right? We're looking for I'm looking for more leadership and direction. And I guess working in technology, I look at what is and what isn't. So I'm more facts-based driven than I am emotionally based at all.
And does optimism play any role in that? Optimism was last on Sally's list, and yet optimism is usually what they tell candidates to crank up in the last few weeks.
Yeah, you know, I'm very optimistic that this is not – I don't believe that this is not unfixable. I don't believe that we're as unbroken as we are led to believe. And I am optimistic that, yes, we can pull out.
And then why do you think the women's vote is fluid? Did you answer that question? Yeah, you sort of did.
I sort of did.
Okay.
But I do, you know.
That's Sally again.
Can I dovetail on that?
Sure.
It's actually, I think that's very indicative of what you're seeing is because right now, this is a snapshot of right now. And, you know, women are apprehensive and, you know, because of everything we've seen in the press, but moving towards optimism, right?
I mean, exactly.
Right? And I think, you know, when in a typical cadence of a campaign, you know, you see, hey, here I am as a candidate. And then the fear comes in. Here's the other guy. The other guy's bad. And then you almost always end with, but here's the path forward. And so women in this particular case are actually in the state right now where they have been in that fear mode. And now I think to saying what you're saying is what's next? I'm not terribly fearful right now. I'm moving towards a place where we actually could have some solutions, whatever you think that solution might be, whether it's an Obama solution or a Romney solution.
So then why do you think it's fluid right now? Because we're moving to this next phase?
Well, I think there's a portion that we're moving to this next phase. And I think more so than men, I believe that women are extraordinarily diverse in our views. The only problem I have with this campaign season, as with others, is it's almost assumed that because I have a uterus, I should vote a certain way. And that's an incorrect statement. And I do believe that the women's vote is so important because we are so diverse in our views and the way that we conduct ourselves on our daily lives and what we believe in.
Why do you think the women's vote, Valerie, is fluid?
You know,
because of uteruses.
Yeah, because of uteri. It's interesting. You know, for me personally, I think that I'm definitely apprehensive, but I'm mostly apprehensive about the fact that I believe we're becoming increasingly ungovernable, that as a country, I think we look at the gridlock in Congress, we look at the divisiveness from state house to state house. That for me is a huge concern, that we have lost the skills of actually arriving at compromise that can work for us. And the possibility, no matter who wins, that the gridlock continues is a huge place of apprehension for me. I think that women's votes have been fluid in part because the campaign's messages have become more diverse. Early in the campaign, it was all going to be a conversation about the economy. And then the choice of Paul Ryan made it about two philosophies for the country. And then we went from two philosophies for the country to issues that directly impact women, healthcare and the right to choose, and just a series of issues have become added to the stew. And I think that many of the issues that have been added have gotten women's attention in a way that when we were just discussing the economy, women were less focused on the the impact of the election on all different kinds of areas of our lives.
Now, you know, what's interesting about this, I heard this morning that a poll result said that women were more focused on economic issues than men were. I think that's how I heard it, because they're working, they have to take care of children and family and parents, and they have to be the ones balancing the checkbook. Do you feel you have been focused, Leah Baltus, on the economy this past year or two?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the idea that women are more often the more employed person in their household, more than their male spouses. I think the idea that they are often the ones who are actually paying the bills physically. I think they're attuned to all of those details, and I think they're paying a lot of attention. And I think that women in general have a lot of patience for connecting the dots among a lot of connected ideas, and they can really see very readily how healthcare and the right to choose, for example, really impact the economic concerns that they have, and that those ideas and issues can't be kept in some sort of separate channel, and that it's all one giant issue really blending together, I think is a very female way of thinking.
That's interesting. But now, what do you think of that? The fluidity, because the ideas have gotten more diverse, but they're all, women are connecting the dots, that the healthcare issues, economic, foreign policy.
I don't know that I 100% agree with that. I mean, I think it's an interesting perspective. I do think that
Sally Poliak, yeah. I should say.
Thank you. I think that the dominant issue in this campaign has been the economy, period. And healthcare plays a part of it in the sense of how much does it cost? How much does it cost me? More than, I think, the social issues of it. Because I think people are so concerned about jobs, how can I pay for X, Y, or Z, my kids coming out of college. I think, if you look at young people, so 4 years ago, Obama had quite an advantage on young people, the hope and optimism. The fact is that the millennials, their unemployment rate is so much higher than any other group of individuals. And so you don't see the motivation. And, even actually Sam Reed predicted that the turnout for the state of Washington is going to be about 4 points less than it was 4 years ago. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that young people are not excited. And one of the reasons they're not excited is because they're feeling disenfranchised because they don't have jobs. Why don't they have jobs? And that's where I would say, from a Romney perspective, he would say we have to be focused on getting jobs for our young people. So, if you look at women, it's the same thing because we have kids, because our millennial kids don't have jobs, because our families, we don't have jobs. We need to get those. And so economy is I think, much more defined in an economic term than I think this holistic term.
And from an Obama perspective, that same question about kids, jobs?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's focused on trying to re-engage them and say, look, at the path forward is something that you can depend on me, and it's having less of a resonation with them. I mean, that's why they're not as excited as 4 years ago. He's having a really tough time with it, and they're focusing very hard on it. But again, it's not as a done deal as it was 4 years ago. It's a lot more work.
Well, and I think that there's also this with regard to the economy, there also is this division in the jobs outlook, right? I mean, private sector is adding jobs. Public sector is shedding jobs faster than the private sector can add jobs. And no one's sort of talking about the transition, regardless of who that candidate is going to be. If the government is getting smaller, there are going to be more unemployed people. The lag between that time and the time that the private sector picks up those jobs is sort of what we're sitting in right now. And I don't know that either candidate really has articulated what this period, this transition period, is really going to be. And that's an element of the, I think, of the apprehension.
Tracy Brooks.
But is that even really something that government, I mean, can a president guarantee you a job?
I think that Mitt Romney just guaranteed 12 million jobs.
Well, Barack Obama did the same thing.
I mean, exactly.
Is this government
that's
is
my
guaranteeing
point.
Jobs really the government's role? Is this something that you should run on? I can't promise you a job. I really can't. I mean,
I don't think that's something you run on.
Yeah. Well, but
politically, I mean.
Politically, no, it's not. But that seems to be what people are expecting, mm-hmm. is that if Barack Obama gets elected, I will get a job. If Mitt Romney gets elected, I will get a job.
What should people expect?
You know, people should expect that I think it's ridiculous to expect that the government should be providing anything for you. Period. I do believe in a smaller government. I do believe that the less government in our lives, the better. I believe that making it easier for private industry to add jobs would go a long way. I really think we start getting into this point, and maybe it kind of almost dovetails on the expectation that, can this candidate relate to me and my family situation? Why?
Leah Baltus?
You say that you don't think that the government should provide anything, but I think there's one thing we can all agree on that government does provide and absolutely has to provide, which is education, at the very least, from kindergarten to 12th grade, if not some kind of support through college. And definitely many of our greatest universities are public institutions. And the education piece is the absolute backbone of the jobs piece. You can't even look at jobs or the economy without thinking about the state of education. So if we're constantly looking at a way to trim back government in a way that education is gutted, and so many of the jobs that we're actually losing in the public sector, as Valerie pointed out, are in education, then we have an enormous problem.
Well, so maybe we should change the way that we define education. Technology is changing. The nature of work is changing. Even over the last 10 years with the advent of technology, manufacturing is going away. You know, are we training our young people for jobs away from that?
I don't think it's just about training people for jobs. I think it's about training people how to think critically and how to collaborate and how to be a part of a team and all these kinds of things that we've been learning from a humanities education for hundreds of years. I think that's a piece of it. And also there is training that comes afterward. But that's job training is something that we're talking about maybe by the time we get into late high school. But we're certainly not talking about job training for fifth graders.
Okay, you respond to that, and then I have two quick questions.
Well, you're preparing fifth graders to go into the workforce, aren't you?
Of course, by teaching them to be part of a team and think critically.
Exactly. But at the end of that, I mean, should we redefine what college is? Should we redefine that role? I mean, it's you have so many kids coming out of college now with liberal arts degrees, and they can't get jobs.
All right, let me hold you there, because I'm going to run out of time. Are you all watching the debates tonight?
No.
No. Are you watching?
Haven't decided yet.
Are you watching, Sally?
I will, but I will be flipping back in between, you know, the baseball game, the football game, and the debate. I have.
Are you watching?
I'm going to DVR it and watch it later.
Now, are you all decided on how you're voting in for the presidential? Are you decided?
Yes.
Are you decided?
Yes.
Are you decided?
Yep.
You're decided.
Yes.
So, I had heard that the third debate was actually very critical in a fluid campaign. You're saying no, but I mean, I thought it was the first debate too, but I also read some things. Sally Polyak said, no, the third debate, when it's a fluid race, is very critical. Do you think this race is done being fluid at this point?
Yeah, I mean, people are moving. There's not a whole lot of undecideds left. The first debate actually moved people. You know, when you look at all the polling and the instant polling and the analysis afterwards, the big score that Romney made in debate number one was, I'm not scary. So when you talk about women voters, you see, you know, even in our emotional trackers, women are not as afraid of Mitt Romney as, you know, the Obama campaign tried to make him.
Or as they were.
As they were.
6 months ago.
Correct.
So who's going to win? Not the debate, but the campaign. I'm just curious what you think.
Obama.
Who do you think is going to win?
I think Romney still is going to do it. I'm optimistic.
And he pulls out Ohio. He gets Florida.
He has to win Ohio.
Yeah. Who do you think will win?
I'm optimistic for Romney as well, if he wins Ohio.
And who do you think is going to win, Valerie?
Right now, I'm sitting here just mortified.
Because you think Mitt Romney's going to win?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that there's a likelihood, which is why I'm working my ass off right now.
All right. Thank you for representing all women today, you guys. Of course you didn't, but I really appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks.
Very much. Around the Water Cooler, Leah Baltus, editor of City Arts Magazine, Valerie Curtis Newton, head of performance at UW School of Drama, Sally Polyak, co-founder and mobilizer for Crowdverb, a digital-first PR firm, and Tracy Brooks, who helps build infrastructure projects like data centers for a technology services provider and as a member of the meetup group Cascade Conservative Chicks. This is Weekday.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News are less than 2 minutes away. The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system.
Support for KUOW comes from APSIA, presenting an International Affairs Graduate Admissions Fair, October 29th at Seattle U Student Center. Candidates can meet with admissions officers from APSIA.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.